Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's tough on Brexit and tough on the causes of Brexit. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hello.
Joining me to talk about the state of Britain are Chair of Birmingham Fabian's Luke John Davis.
Hello.
Deputy Leader of Birmingham City Council Bridget Jones.
Hello.
And Chief Scrutineer of all things West Midlands Councillor John Cotton.
Hello.
2.5 years ago, David Cameron called a referendum to settle the European question and stop the Tories from banging on about Europe. Now, limited success, I think we could say at the moment, but maybe what's clear from a lot of academic studies is that the Leave vote in many areas was driven by economic insecurity. I think it's also fair to say the government at the moment is doing jack all to actually address this economic insecurity because all the bandwidth of the government is being taken up by trying to negotiate through Brexit. And so what we want to do was have a little bit of a pause and talk about all the issues in Britain which are not being dealt with because of Brexit. Think about what those issues are, maybe even think about how we can solve them as well. We're going to do this again after a rather unnecessarily jaunty theme tune. So, John, something that's gone up massively since 2010 is homelessness and rough sleepers, not only just in Birmingham, but in Britain as a whole. And this week, there was a crisis report on homelessness which was released, which just shows how stark the problem is, wasn't there?
Yeah, and I think the crisis report really illustrates what all of us know if we just take a walk around Birmingham city centre. The rise in rough sleeping and in homelessness has been absolutely shocking over the course of the last 8 years. So what the crisis report did, they did some independent research and they're saying that we're now in a situation where there's something like 24,000 people in this country who are rough sleeping, or if they're not rough sleeping, they're on public transport, you know, sort of like spending the night on buses or on trains in order to keep out of the cold. That's quite a stark contrast to what the official rough sleeping figures are, which claim there's around about 5,000 people rough sleeping. I think from my experience of having been involved in rough sleep accounts and from all the evidence I've seen within Birmingham, the crisis report is much closer to the reality than those official figures are. And if you take those crisis numbers, that basically means there's been a 98% increase in rough sleeping since 2010. And there's been over 100% increase in the number of people who are either sleeping in tents or on buses or finding those kind of unacceptable alternative arrangements. So this is the absolute sort of epitome of the social crisis that austerity and the very brutal welfare policies that this government has implemented over the last 8 years have impacted on some of the most vulnerable people in our society.
Does the report go into what the causes are? Is it mainly universal credit and the changes around there?
Yeah, I mean, what's really clear is the changes to welfare have really driven this increase in homelessness. Universal credit is the latest iteration of that, but of course the roots go back earlier. You need to look at the impact of earlier policies around sanctions, impact of the earlier changes like the bedroom tax, the changes to housing benefit and what that meant for a whole cohort of vulnerable people. You go out and you talk to organisations at the front line of this, and they've been clear for a very long time that it's the direct impact of those policies brought through by government that has driven the increase in homelessness. And also, there's just the raw fact, you look at those numbers, a 98% increase since 2010, since that Tory-led government first came into office. You compare it to the record of the previous Labour government, where we had, to all intents and purposes, practically eradicated rough sleeping in this country. I think the evidence is really starkly speaks for itself.
One of the other drivers of this, a sort of unexpected driver, which I read in the UN report that came out a little while ago on poverty in the UK, is the move towards digitalisation of the welfare system, because not everyone has access to a smartphone or the internet or the skills to use it. And it's an anecdote, I suppose, rather than a sort of set of statistics, but I used to volunteer at the B30 Food Bank, And I had one client who came in to receive his parcel and had to sign with an ex who was literally illiterate. He'd left school at 14. He was in his mid-50s. He'd left school at 14 and had worked as a builder's labourer. Been more or less in work, paid his taxes, paid his stamp, paid his way as a builder's labourer until his mid-50s, and his back went. And he can't carry heavy items. Now, you can't obviously work on a building site if you can't carry things. He can't even get a job on a till because he can't read the till. He was there, he was in the food bank because he'd been sanctioned. And the reason he'd been sanctioned was because he hadn't done enough online job applications. Now, if you can't read, how the hell are you supposed to do online job applications? And to be fair to the DWP, they had taken this into account. They had let him know where he could go to get support to learn literacy.
By letter?
By letter. They wrote him a letter to say, there is how you can learn to read. I mean, it's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous, that that kind of situation has not been foreseen.
They'll say, go to your library, because that has internet access.
Which have all been cut.
Figures released last week that John's quoted, when you translate them to Birmingham numbers, we're looking at round about 4,000 children who are officially homeless in Birmingham. Now, if you translate that into a per school number, we're talking about 10 kids in every school in the city who are homeless. What's led us here is systematic stripping out, as Luke and John have said, of all of the safety nets that might have caught people previously. But also, we're leading ourselves into a spiral of decline here. So if you think about those 10 kids per school, the impact on their results is massive. The extra resources having to go in to prop them up and the situation that they're in is massive. The drain on services to other kids and families, because there's nothing, there simply isn't enough service to go round, will lead for more of them to fall into that situation or other issues to arise. You're facing a spiral of decline here, which, if it isn't arrested by shutting off the supply of people becoming homeless, by removing the sanctions that have been talked about, but also by putting back in some of those safety nets that used to catch people, unless we start doing that, we are going to keep spiraling down. That's a really scary place to be.
We are going to mention Brexit a little bit, just because, but the impact of Brexit on the home building sector, in that a lot of people who are EU nationals work as builders and in the home building sector. And almost to tie the point you were making earlier, LJ, as well, about the use of technology, as part of May's deal, part of the way that EU citizens and EU nationals living in the UK are going to be registering under this new system, where they might not have to try and get their settler status, is on a smartphone and on an Android smartphone. So iPhones can't be being used.
Specific as well. It has to be Android 6.0 or greater.
Yeah, exactly. iPhones are not welcome.
The move to digitisation and the way that the government has actually handled the digitisation efforts is an absolute case study in many ways in incompetence. To take this example of like only one specific operating system for a smartphone being able to be used, and a very specific version of that operating system able to be used, it actually goes back, like, it does a complete 180 on what has been government operating procedure for the kind of digital initiatives for basically ever since digital initiatives were a thing. It used to be that websites, any website that the government produced, had to be compatible with every single version of web browsers that are out there. Now, this is one of the reasons why websites cost so much more for local governments and for the central government, is because they had this restriction in place, which meant if you were using Internet Explorer 4, the website had to load up in it as well. Now, the reality is, no one other than a handful of people is using Internet Explorer 4 because everybody's upgraded onto that.
I don't know, local government tech is still pretty bad.
But generally speaking, most people are off of it, these sorts of things. They've migrated onto different things, especially as you move onto different versions of Windows and you have the latest version of whatever came of Internet Explorer. But just because there is quite possibly someone out there who is still using that, and they need to be able to access that website so they can fill in their council tax form online or whatever, it was mandated that all websites needed to work with it. It massively drove up the costs, and in some ways not necessary in a lot of the time. But that 180 shift away from that to this super hyper focused of only one specific OS is just a drastic shift. And it's kind of gone from one end of problems of things costing too much because you're trying to make it accessible to everybody, to it being hyper-focused on probably on cost and not thinking through accessibility.
Mm. I feel like there's a lack of empathy at the moment with a lot of people in government about how other people live their lives. I mean, we talked this about before on the podcast about even things like introducing voter ID into voting, which I think was tried at the local elections earlier this year. 2 or 3 million people, I don't think, have any form of photo ID. And it feels like it's being driven forward by a Tory government, which assumes that everyone has a form of photo ID. Mm. And you mentioned the UN report, LJ, and we will, I think, talk more about that later. And one of the things that is, I think, striking about that is the difference between the poverty that he sees and then the absolute disconnect and denial from people in government about the things that are going on.
So you mentioned the lack of empathy with the way people live their lives, but I think it's more a symptom of how divided the country is. I genuinely think people are making these policies, are making them without reference to people because they simply don't know them and have not come across them. Mm. It's the same symptom we saw actually in education policy for quite a long time. Most Tory education policy was written with reference to largely monocultural, more rural or small town schools without accounting for the complexities of a big city. Exactly the same thing applies to most of their other policies because they don't represent diverse places, because they don't represent areas of with complexity and mass poverty. They don't necessarily understand them. And it's ignorance, I think, rather than lack of empathy in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And to go back to that UN report, there is a line on that because the UN report is very critical of what it referred to as the mentality of austerity. British compassion for those who are suffering has been replaced by a punitive, mean-spirited and callous approach. And I think that's both at the level of the government, which is what you've just been talking about, but also at the level of individuals in the street. You know, that notion of solidarity, of, to coin a phrase, we're all in this together, has gone because we are all, you know, we're all now encouraged to be consumers, not citizens. We are encouraged to play on identities rather than on people. You know, it's all these kind of things.
I think I agree. Well, I agree with you on the first bit. I'm not so sure I agree with you entirely on the second bit, because if you look at the degree to which active and concerned citizens are stepping up to the plate when it comes to, you know, food bank collection, for instance, or those tremendous people who are going out every night into the Birmingham city centre and elsewhere to ensure that people who are sleeping on the street have got a hot meal and have got at least, you know, dry bedding, all of that stuff, which is sticking plaster over the kind of great wounds that have been hewed into our society. But there's a real sense, I think, amongst people that this has gone too far, and that people are prepared to step up, and actually there is still more of a common interest than perhaps you might immediately assume, given how atomised and individualistic parts of society have become.
I think that's right, but I think I'm more referring to about the public discourse. You know, if you go back to the 20s and 30s, people who had ended up on welfare were referred to as unfortunates. You know, it was not their fault. It was bad luck. It was something unfortunate that had happened to them. Whereas now they are scroungers and losers, which is the moral blame has been shifted onto the individual.
So I'm going to bring a slightly more pessimistic disagreement back to this. I don't think people are kicking back about this to the extent that we'd like to think they are. Remember, if we held a general election tomorrow, Labour still wouldn't win it. The Tories would still, more than likely, have a minority government. I was in a debate with sixth formers a couple of weeks ago, and I was really struck by, A, how good the debate was. There's some brilliant questions they were posing to a sort of question time style panel. But one of the questions they posed was, is Theresa May the best Prime Minister for the times we're in? Remember, there's still a lot of sixth formers who are in the audience, and I was the last correspondent to come back. And every other respondent said, actually, yeah, she's doing a good job right now, you know, difficult times, but she's powering through, she's got courage, she's going to deliver, you know, some level of Brexit. She's the only one that wants the job. You've got to respect her for what she's doing at the moment. And what really struck me was how all of these sixth formers, who had been really liberal on loads of the other questions that we'd had, were nodding along and agreeing. And I had to bring the other perspective last in the argument, which was, okay, you might respect her courage right now, but you've got to remember she's a woman that literally sent vans around areas of high immigration telling people to go home. She has been around the cabinet table and decided on all of these policies that have led to the kind of poverty that we are talking about. The level of kickback that we would like to think is there, we have seen amazing people doing amazing things, as John has said, like, you know, running food banks, outreach and so on. Is that as widespread as we'd like to think it is? Has the British public really cottoned on to just how bad things are? Are they willing to do the simple act of walking into a voting booth and putting an X next to a name that will change some of this? I don't think they are yet, and that's really scary.
So for me, it feels like a lot of... If you look at things like social attitude surveys, I think a lot of the public attitudes have shifted to less, I think, feel like people on welfare are scroungers, and most people think it's their unfortunate rather than being their own fault. And even on immigration, say, it feels like attitudes to immigration have softened since the Brexit vote. Who do they trust to deliver on the solutions to that? I think people aren't necessarily sold that a Labour government will do that yet.
So I think part of that actually is that Labour isn't necessarily seen as the party that will do that, because Labour is still very middle-class metropolitan professionals, and it's seen as condescending. Not just Labour, I mean Social Democratic parties more broadly. As one of the people I was talking to about the SPD put it, you know, we like our electorate, we just don't understand them. We're not part of their milieu, we're not part of them, in terms of the sort of working-class, traditional Labour voters. We've become a party of Guardian readers, essentially. You know, the reason Take Back Control was such a powerful slogan is that most people do not feel like they have control over their lives. And when we come along and say, don't worry, we're going to fix it because we know what's best for you, which can be the attitude of some people, across, and that's not that's across the wings, right? That's not an ideological point. That attitude is across from Progress to Momentum and everything in between. It's not an ideological point, but that sort of attitude causes problems. But it does explain partly why it's not, you know, that support is not necessarily coming straight back to the Labour Party.
Finding myself in the unusual position of being the most optimistic when it comes to public attitudes, I think there is a shift that has taken place over the 8 years that we've had this really brutal level of austerity. Because if I think back to having conversations with the electorate sort of back in 2011, 2012, 2013, when we were warning, you know, here in Birmingham about the end of local government as we've known it, and saying, look, literally look at the graph of demand for council services versus the graph that shows the declining amount of resource that's going to be available. And, you know, we were almost, we were told we were making too much of it. And actually conversations you'd have on doorsteps are frequently the kind of, yeah, but you still waste an awful lot of money on this, that and the other. Those conversations don't happen so much now, because I think people are actually seeing in front of their face the real impacts of austerity, what it's doing to public services, what it's doing to the services that they and their families rely on. And I think there's a better understanding of where this has come from. So, and I think that perhaps explains some of what happened with the general election last year. I think there was a bit of a dam that finally broke around austerity. It's gone too far. And I think there's a greater sympathy towards some of those who've been most affected by it than was the case 4 or 5 years ago. I'm not saying that we've won the argument entirely, but I think we're in a different place on that in terms of the public.
No.
The question about how we seal the deal politically with the electorate and how we really engage and offer that viable and credible alternative to them, that's still very much a work in progress. And I think, you know, there's a whole series of different conversations we need with different communities who are in different places around that, if that makes sense. But I do think there is a change in attitude there, because people are now seeing what these brutal cuts have done to the social fabric and have done to individuals' lives.
Birmingham City Council, Britain's largest local authority, is down £690 million a year since 2010. What that equates to, we're talking around about 8,000 staff that we've lost. We've currently got a staffing complement of about 12,000. And if you think about what local government provides, so everyone thinks it's the potholes, the trees, the libraries and so on, it's actually the bulk of our budget, two-thirds of our budget goes on children's and adult social care. We are seeing rising demand because of all of the other stresses on society that everybody else has been talking about at a time of falling resource. The government's theory is that local government should be self-financing, within a few years, and that we should be able to raise funds from council tax and business rates. The reality of that is that council tax varies drastically across different local authorities as a proportion of what it, what our income is. It's just an insane tax when you look into it. The ability of councils to raise council tax is drastically restricted by the government, who puts a limit on it each year as to what you can raise. Whilst the rhetoric is councils raising their own funds and spending their own funds, the reality is the slow, steady decline of local government and all of the services it provides, and that compounding into the issues of homelessness and so on that everyone's been talking about.
And I don't want to bring in the Brexit elephant in the room again, but if the government's idea is to try and get councils to raise money through business rates, Brexit, I'm going to say, is probably going to have a negative impact on business in Britain, the amount of money they can raise. I'm too depressed to finish that sentence, so LJ.
I mean, I was just going to make the point, I think council tax, and I'm sure Bridget or John will correct me, is about 7 or 8% of Birmingham's budget.
It was 7, well, this is the thing. So when I first started quoting that stat, it was 7%, but the cuts to central government grant have been so drastic.
Yeah.
That it now compromises 11%, despite having barely gone up by 2% a year. Yeah.
So essentially what's got to happen is either the council's got to be cut to the point where it is doing 10% of what it's doing at the moment, which basically is well below the legal statutory minimum of what it has to be doing, or council tax has got to increase tenfold, which I don't think people are prepared to pay, or have the ability to pay.
Well, yeah, absolutely. If you're basing the majority of local government financing on business rates, it just absolutely doubles down and entrenches the inequality across the country.
Mm.
Because you're going to have areas that do have vibrant areas of business growth. You know, hopefully, but you see that certainly in the centre of Birmingham. But for some of those places that we define as left behind, the sort of the towns of the Midlands and the North, the places that were so angry that they came out and voted for Brexit, you're not going to have the kind of business rate base that's going to be able to drive the kind of regeneration and improvements that those places need. The other thing is that this is being done in quite a cynical way. The government has basically given preferential treatment to the counties, to the rural areas, to the Tory grassroots areas, at the expense of the urban areas of the Midlands and the North. So we've seen, you know, transitional funding put in, for instance, to help counties who've been starting to feel the financial pinch. And the classic is, if you look at spending power, which is the government's own measure of what an authority has available to it. So West Sussex saw a 4.3% cut in its spending power. So that's on the government's own figures. And they then got something like £20 million in top-ups through various grants. Knowsley, up in just outside of Liverpool, saw a 32% cut in its spending power and hasn't had a penny in a top-up. And then there's other little ruses, like how road funding's distributed. So it's based on the length of the road rather than the usage of the road. So that means that places like Rutland get far more money than many of the urban areas do. So it is that the system is being utterly biased in favour of areas that essentially where the Tory grassroots support, grassroots vote is, rather than in the interest of the nation as a whole. It just doubles down on all of these social issues we've been talking about.
I'd never even thought about the gerrymandering of road funding being a thing.
It's amazing what you can dream up in the bowels of DCLG.
I've had, just staring at me, the figures from the UN report, and I think we can sometimes feel like, almost if we say that communities are kind of left behind or we talk about an increase in poverty, it can sound like it's not many people. But what the UN report figures are that 14 million people live in poverty, so that's a fifth. 4 million of those are 50% below the poverty line, so can't afford basic essentials. And apparently, there's predictions of, in the 2020s, child poverty could be as high as 40%. Yeah.
In Birmingham, it's already 42%.
And it's not just, I mean, this is economic inequality, but if we finish off, we can talk about racial inequality, Steve. We had a Guardian report this year on the various racial inequalities. And we haven't had a chance to talk about that, but it's interesting how those from BME backgrounds felt that they were more overlooked by promotion, more likely to be have entry refused to a restaurant, more likely to fail a driving test. All these kind of hidden biases, I suppose, in the system, which seem to be stacked against a lot.
Yeah, fundamentally, what this report found was that the everyday existence of ethnic minorities in the UK is vastly different to people who happen to be white. To run through some of the stats very quickly, 38% of people from ethnic minorities said they'd been wrongly suspected of shoplifting in the past 5 years, compared to 14% of white people. Minorities more than twice as likely to have encountered abuse or rudeness from a stranger in the last week. 53% of people from a minority background believe they'd been treated differently because of their hair, clothes or appearance, compared with 29% of white people. Fundamentally, the everyday experience of ethnic minorities is drastically different to what white people are experiencing themselves. It is an absolute scandal that Britain in this day and age is like this. We could spend an awful lot of time kind of just going through the stats and the report in more detail. But fundamentally, what we need to do as a country is look to solutions to this and say, how can we get to a point where that experience is no longer the case? And really, we need to do that. We need to start looking at what are the root causes of it. Now, not everybody in the UK is obviously an EDL style racist who's going around threatening to beat up Muslims because they're all paedophiles who are trying to abuse young kids or whatever it is they seem to think these days. But as a society, we have a number of areas where we need to start looking at how we are talking about people who are from ethnic minorities. And actually, over the past week or so, there's been a really good example of this in that Raheem Sterling, the England footballer, came out and posted something on one of his social media feeds and basically just called out the press for the amount of crap he'd been getting from them because of his actions. Now, his actions included things like buying a house for his mom.
Something disgusting.
Something other footballers had also done and had been written about, and the tone was drastically different. Other examples of Raheem Sterling's appalling behaviour is flying an EasyJet or Ryanair flight for £80 rather than taking a more expensive flight. But when he did take a more expensive flight, he was condemned for doing that as well.
Hmm.
Then, of course, we have this situation where Raheem Sterling got a tattoo on his leg of a rifle, of a gun, immediately condemned for, you know, encouraging violence in young people, despite the fact it's a tattoo. It has no meaning other than it being a tattoo.
Yeah, and I think it was on his shooting foot, and you know that was the reference.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, the notion that Raheem Sterling is encouraging gun violence is obscene when you really know that his dad was killed by bullets when he was about 2 years old, I think it was.
And he spent a lot of his life actually campaigning against it and working with kids to get them out of that.
Yeah.
But really, what this shows is a classic example of how the media is fueling, in many ways, the level of racism we're seeing in this country. Now, the Raheem Sterling is a very kind of granular example, but more broadly, you can look at the BBC. And the way it's covered the rise of UKIP, the way it talks about Tommy Robinson and those sorts of things. They treated UKIP as a talk, and Nigel Farage in particular, as a talking head, an oddity that needed to, that was good for bringing in ratings. They didn't treat him as seriously as a politician. With Tommy Robinson, they're using him and his discourse as discussion points constantly, which in turn gives him and his views legitimacy they should not have. The media across all forms, whether it be print, whether it be television or whatever, has in its desperate bid for ratings or clicks or whatever, and the desperate need to create content, is fueling all of this.
2 points, I suppose, on that. One is just with regard to the BBC. I think their very strange interpretation of what's now meant by impartiality, which seems to be, we just take, as long as we give fair airing to both sides of an argument, when we're kind of equidistant, we're being impartial. That kind of mission to explain, that challenging of facts versus fallacy, seems to have disappeared from a lot of BBC. And I'm, you know, always been a great supporter of the BBC and the concept of public service broadcasting. But the frustration I now feel, you know, when Farage has appeared on Question Time
no matter how many times, despite the fact he's not even leader of a party that has no MPs and, you know, isn't really part of that discourse. The kind of normalisation of the Tommy Robinson really far right stuff that we've seen through Newsnight and various other programmes, that is an abdication, I think, of the BBC's responsibility with regard to being fair and impartial around facts and that mission to explain. And I think there's an issue there. The Stirling stuff was a really classic example of the kind of dog whistle bigotry that elements of the tabloid press have been involved in for years. You know, always think back to that hideous cartoon that I think was in The Sun in the early 80s about the Irish as a poster for an X-rated movie. I mean, hideous, absolutely blatantly racist stuff. But they've got away with this for years and years. And I do think the one thing that has changed, made me think that it had changed, was watching the very whiny Sun editorial in response to the criticism about how they covered Raheem Sterling. Basically whining, oh, it's nothing to do with us, you know, it's terrible that people are making these statements, but, you know, nothing to do with us at all. I do think that the Sun of the 1980s wouldn't have even printed the whiny editorial because there was no way of actually systematically calling it out. And one of the benefits, I think, that comes from social media, more interactive world, is that voices that can challenge can get the platform and can come back far quicker. So the kind of flip side of the negative elements of social media and the platform it gives it to is that there's a better accountability if it's used properly. And so they are being pushed into a space where they're having to justify a little bit more what they're doing. But, you know, we're far away from being in perfect times yet on this.
That was almost optimistic, though, John. I'm a bit worried.
I'm a bit worried about how optimistic I'm getting at the moment.
We'll get the men in grey suits to have a word with you after the podcast.
Have you been drinking Bridget's homemade wine already, John?
No. That's what we're going to be doing on the quiz next week. We have a website, notenoughchampagne.com, and we have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne, and a Twitter handle, which is @nochampagnepod. James Crown designed our logo, and Dave Depper is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm on Twitter @paperbackrioter.
I'm @CouncillorJohnCotton.
I'm Bridget Jones.
@ElgerDavies1987.
@AcousticRadical.
Happy plotting.